This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
And we'll move into the Gemara. Tonight is in fact my father's yahrzeit, as it turns out. So I thought we would do the piece of Gemara that actually is on the daf of tonight, or tonight and tomorrow. And it's very, as I looked at the daf, it's daf Pei Beis in Kesubis.
The last daf of Perek Shmini.
And it's quite interesting because it's a relatively kind of straightforward technical and from a philosophic perspective almost a dry daf, but as you know already by now, there's no daf that's dry. You've just got to be able to mine the beauty in each daf of Gemara and find the relevance in each daf of Gemara. So we'll do the last piece of that daf, which is the very last piece of the Perek, and it's a very easy piece of Gemara. And a very interesting piece of Gemara that also gives us a new insight into the reason for Ksuba, and quite a disappointing statement on the nature of the human being. And it starts from the two dots about 15 lines from the bottom. This all this whole Gemara revolves around the Mishnah on Daf Pei Amud Beis, and previously the whole Perek really is talking about the Shibud Nechosim for a Ksuba. Shibud Nechosim means the fact that a man's property is bonded for the payment of the Ksuba. So a woman has a first right, a woman through her Ksuba, a woman's Ksuba has a first claim on a man's property in the event that he can't pay out cash if he dies or divorces her. That's the principle. And this piece of Gemara gives the background to that law on what is the basis for his property being bonded. And there's some significant ramifications to his property being bonded. Number one, the heirs can't get hold of it, although they inherit him and she's not an heir. She needs to be taken care of by the children, but she's not an heir. But her rights of ksuba come before the rights of inheritance. And if the husband has sold all his property and there's nothing left in the estate, if he's tried to hide his property in trusts and things like that, makes no difference. She can go, she can claim the property even if it's been sold 10 times. She can go and claim the property rights. At the time they get married, that property becomes bonded to her, and in Torah terms, when something becomes bonded, it's a form of ownership. It's a right to claim. It's almost a form of ownership. So he can't alienate it. He can sell it. He can do what he wants with it in the sense, provided he's got the money to pay out. But in the event that he sold the property and doesn't have the money to pay out, that the money can be claimed from the property. But it wasn't always that way. That was an institution of Shimon ben Shetach. And the Gemara tonight gives us some kind of a historic sense of how that came about, and in it you'll see how halachic evolution worked. Omar Rav Yehuda said, "Barishoino hayu kosvim libetulo masayim v'la'amon amon." In the old days, they used to write a ksuba very simply, giving a previously unmarried woman 200 zuz, and an almona, a widow or a divorcee would get 100 in the ksuba. And there was no mention of the property being bonded. In fact, according to some, they very often used to write, "My property is not bonded." There's a machlokes in the Gemara as to whether property is automatically bonded to indebtedness, or whether you specifically have to say that in the document. And the halacha is that you don't have to specifically say that. If you write a document of indebtedness, a loan, or whatever it is, then property is automatically bonded, but you can deliberately say in the shtar, in the document, you can say, "My property is not bonded. This debt can only be claimed from movable property, but not from immovable property." So let's say he wrote in his ksuba for her, or he wrote in her ksuba, This that I owe you can only be claimed from cash or from movable property, not from immovable property. And it wasn't a good situation. And men used to get old and didn't used to get married. Says Rashi, why not? The men didn't want to get married, the women didn't want to marry them. Omru lechashiyomus or yegarish, if he dies or divorces me, loydin saligves klum, I'm going to go out with nothing. I'm now working, he gets the rights to my income, and I'll be with him for a while, and he'll drop dead, or he'll divorce me, and then what happens to the money? Shayoshim yatzniu mo'ez shel yerusha. The yoshim, the heirs, will hide the money away. They'll make sure that it's hidden in some Swiss bank trust account, and I won't be able to get my hands on it. So what do I want to get into the situation? I would rather have my independence. That's what was happening. Now, it's possible also that it's talking about second marriages. So that older men couldn't find women to marry because they were children already, and the second wife was afraid to get involved, and now the children from the first wife are going to take, but she doesn't need it. So she was happy to, not happy, but she would rather stay alone than land herself in an impoverished situation, reliant on the children from the previous marriage. She just didn't want to go there. And she was afraid there was no way, the money was not secure. Now let's pause there and understand a little bit about that. Let's go on and then we'll pause. Ad Shebo Shimon ben Shetach, until Rabbi Shimon ben Shetach came, the Tikein kol nechosov achroin l'ksufto, and he put in the words that we now have in the ksubit, which is all my property is bonded to the payment of this ksubit. So the ksubit is an important document that gives her a sense of financial security. So we can talk around this quite a lot. Just the central idea then of the ksuba certainly is one of security, because that which the woman needs most is a sense of security. She needs financial security and she needs emotional security. That's her biggest need, is to feel a sense of security. And one of the causes of most marital dissatisfaction or even ultimate breakdown is a woman who feels insecure. A woman who either doesn't feel loved, or she doesn't feel cared for, or she's financially insecure. She's worried financially. It's much harder for a woman to go out and earn and generate, particularly in those times, and until recent times it was very hard for a woman to generate income. For a man, if he didn't have money, he could go out and work and he could generate money. But a woman, if she didn't have money, was very dependent, and she didn't want to get into a situation where she might be dependent on the children for her income and not be able to claim her ksuba. So one of the reasons for the ksuba we see right away is to give the woman a sense of security. And if what Shimon ben Shetach found is, even with the ksuba she didn't have a sense of security, because the money wasn't secured. There was an indebtedness. The husband owed her money, and even if he was a wonderful guy and they had a good relationship, she realized that if that relationship changes and they decide to split up, or he dies, she could be left with nothing. So she was feeling insecure during the lifetime of the marriage, and that's not healthy for a marriage. A relationship in which a woman feels insecure is not a good relationship. That's not a worthwhile relationship. One of the things that men don't understand is that the whatever they need to invest in making their wives feel secure is a source of great happiness for them. It's not a matter of giving something away to their wives. It's something of securing their own happiness. Their own happiness is the outcome of a secure wife, of the wife who feels secure. And that's really, really important. And that's one element of that. Is the meaning of the kesuva. Now let's go further. Omar Rav Yehuda, Tanya Nami Hachi, we've also learned this in a brisa. So the brisa actually tracks the evolution from the way it used to be till Shimon ben Shetach. It wasn't done in one step. There were several phases to this regulation. And what were the phases? Barishoino you kusvin libasula mosaim vila almona mone, says the Brisa. As we just learned in the Gemara, in the beginning, they used to write 200 for a basula, 100 for an almona, and there were no, and there was no shibud, there were no bonds and mortgages. V'hoyu mazkinim v'lo ayu noisim noshim. And the men used to get old and didn't used to marry. So, hitkinu shiyu menichin oiso beveis avio. So they made a takona, they legislated, and they said at the time of marriage, when you make a ksuba, you actually hand over the money and deposit it into her father's bank account. So she's actually got the money. That's what you need to do. So they thought this was, and that would give her a great sense of security. And the ksuba was not just a nominal amount of money. And even in Israel today, when they write ksubas, and the ksubas are part of the settlements in the event of divorce, here we have anti-natural contracts and all sorts of other ways of sorting it out, and the laws of the country sort it out in the absence of other agreements. But in at that time, the ksuba was the undertaking. A woman had no rights other than contractual rights, so the ksuba was the contract. And so what they introduced now was that at the time of the wedding, he would actually pay the money over and give it to her father, and her father would put it away in a trust for her in the event of death or divorce of her husband. And that way she would feel better. But it wasn't, they solved one problem and they created another problem. What was the problem they created? If he got angry in a moment of anger, go and take your money and go. That's what he would say. Now, why would he say that more now than before? Before, so he could have given her money and let her go. Yeah, the answer is, if anybody's been to Disney World, then in Disney World you'll find the answer. The designers of Disney World understood this piece of Gemara. And since then, other places have followed the same idea. When you go to Disney World, it's quite expensive. Paying the entrance fee is quite hefty. I don't remember what it is, but it's quite a lot of money. And particularly South Africans are quite shocked that anybody could think of paying that amount of money just to go to an amusement park. It's a hefty fee. But once you're in, you don't pay again. And they figured out, it's hard to pay. It doesn't matter if you're paying 5 rand or dollars, or you're paying $100. It's hard to pay. So have the pain once, and then you can have fun. If every time you're going to have to make a purchase decision, should we go on this ride or shouldn't we? Or should we let the children have this or shouldn't we let the children have it? Then every time it's an agony. So no agony. Agony is at the beginning, and then after that you can have fun. That's the principle in this Gemara. If he has to pay, if he loses his temper and he says, look, take your money and go, take your money means put your hand in your pocket and take your checkbook out and write a check, well, maybe I'll calm down. Maybe it's not really worth the money to have her go. But if the money's already been paid, it's an easy decision. And so now we're seeing another element in the idea of the ksuba is to make the divorce decision harder. That's not because the Torah doesn't allow divorce. Of course the Torah allows divorce, and that's part of the morality of marriage. The Torah considers it immoral to force people to stay together who don't want to be together. And it's not in anybody's interest. It's not good. But sometimes people go through a moment of anger. The marriage goes through a period of turbulence. And there's an immediate sense of, let's just split up and just get rid of all of this. And one can easily do it. The thing that calms you down is the cost. If it costs a lot, then it's not so quick that we're going to do that. That's how credit cards work. The whole idea of buying on credit is that if you had to pay for everything, then you would stop and think. And you wouldn't buy as much. But a credit card makes it easy. It makes it feel as if you're not really paying. The casinos have got the same idea. You know, buy your chips, and now it's just plastic things you're paying with. It makes it easier to make a purchase decision. So here too, they were worried that if they made him pay the ksuba in advance, there was no pain to the divorce decision. And that could happen too spontaneously and impulsively, and they could regret it afterwards. So they didn't solve that problem. So he's kinush yumenichin oisa beveis chamio. So they said, no, well then in that case, still, write the money, I write the check out at the time of the marriage, and it stays in your house. Give it to her in the form of ashiras oisa oisa kolosa shel keset b'shel zo. The wealthy girls who had big kesubas used to convert the money into kalosis is a kind of a beautiful head covering, but what it really is made of silver and gold. It's an item of jewelry. So they would go and buy an expensive piece of jewelry with a ksuba, and they would wear it and enjoy it during the marriage. It's in the Gemara, many Gisors, that is not there. The poorer women used to convert it into some other form of utensil that could be used around the house, but it was a private utensil that she used for herself. So what have we gained now? So now, he's paid out the money, he's given it over to her, but she's got it in the form of jewelry, which means if he runs short of money, he can borrow the jewelry from her, and he can bond it or pawn it or do whatever he wants. There's an asset that he can get his hands on. And therefore, he realizes if he's going to divorce his wife, she takes the diamonds with. And having the diamonds in the common household has a certain advantage. He's not so quick to do that. So now the whole ksuba becomes really quite interesting. Because it's not something that's given to her as a gift. It's his, but she has the rights to it. So it's an economic bond. It's a financial bond between the two of them. There was once when I was in the jewelry business, I had a customer who used to just, she was an amazing saleswoman, and she used to sell the most gigantic gems. And I once asked her, how does she do it? Does she sell to the man? Does she sell to the woman? How do you sell these gigantic things for so much money? And she says that she sells to the women at the time that they're getting married. And she explains to them, she says, well, have a look at the divorce rate, and my girl, if you walk out, that's what you're going to walk out with. So you go back to the guy, and you tell him there's no deal, unless this is the stone he buys. And that's how she used to do it. So there it's different. There it's kind of securing your future, which is one of the elements of the ksuba, securing her future, but then the other element of it is to make the divorce harder. And yes, she used to then convert it into jewelry, and having the jewelry in the common household made it a little bit harder. It introduced some level of rationality to the decision. What is it about the relationship between spending and the impulsiveness? What is the Gemara touching on over here? It seems to be that we're not impulsive about paying out money. It's the one thing we're not impulsive about. We're impulsive about acquiring. We're impulsive about getting things. But the one thing a man gets into analytical mode about is cost. That doesn't happen so quickly. So he looks and says, yeah, isn't that beautiful? Yeah, it's beautiful. How much does it cost? Oh, well, all of a sudden the beauty of it is no longer the element. He's into the cost. That's how a man works. Cost brings him into analysis, and analysis cools the passions down. It's one of the ways to cool passion. If you want to cool the passion down, start doing calculations. And that's what a man does. He calculates, and once he's calculated, he calms down. We want him to get into calculation mode. Not when he marries his wife. When he marries his wife, we don't want him to be in calculation mode. When he marries his wife, we want him to fall in love and marry her and love her and want her and not be in calculation mode. If he were in calculation mode when he got married, he wouldn't get married. He wouldn't do it. So the Ribbono Shel'olam introduced an insanity called falling in love so that people become impulsive and do things that are crazy. The Gemara says, Chazal say, that love, as does hatred, any intense emotion, distorts the thinking process. It distorts the analysis. Do you have any idea what it costs to get married? What do you think is a matter of interest? What does it cost a man to get? What does it cost a couple to get married? Including everything. We'll figure it out this way. Raising a child costs about $1 million. Till post-university. To get the child a BA costs around $1 million. So 2, 3, 4 kids, you're talking about $3, 4, 5 million. That is 30 million rand around there we're talking about. Now you tell me, what young man is going to marry a woman if he knows it's going to cost him 30 million rand? He just doesn't think. And thank God he doesn't think. And how do people get the 30 million rand? I have no idea. That's a miracle. It's total missing. I've done the calculation with people over and over again, and it's $1 million a child. That's what it is. A little bit less in some countries, $700,000, $800,000. In the United States, it's $1 million. Here, I understand it's a little bit less, but not a whole lot less. What young person has that? And when you do the cheshbon, the money isn't there. It isn't going to be there and never was there, except for a privileged few. Where does it come from? How do people manage it? Some people get into terrible debt, but many don't. They somehow manage. It's an unbelievable mess how people come out. And you don't even, I've often said, you don't even have to, for miracles, you don't even have to look at that. Just look at your monthly budgets and figure out at the beginning of a month what the month is going to cost you. And the chances are, you come to the conclusion, you're actually not going to make it. And you do make it. And sometimes you're short a bit, and sometimes you're over a bit, kind of, one makes it. And you look at a year, at how much it costs to keep a family going for a year. And what it costs and what you earn don't match in most cases. And yet, thank God, many people get through without getting into terrible debt. And that's part of the miracle of economics. It's an absolute miracle of economics that abolition provides. But if you start getting into too much analysis of the cost of everything, nothing's ever going to work. Even in investment, if you buy a share and you think of how much it costs, you won't buy it. You've got to have enough of a gut feel to say, this is a good thing. So what we want in the case of divorce, we want the reverse. In the case of divorce, we want him to think of cost. This is going to cost you. So be sure it's what you want. And don't do it on impulse. This is something you've got to calculate. And so we introduce, and when they introduced the takona that you prepay the ksuba amount and deposit it with the father-in-law, that wasn't good, because the pain of payment was at the time of the marriage, and that he didn't mind paying at that time so much, because he wanted to marry the girl, and later on there was no pain, the money was paid already. That wasn't any good, so they changed it. Even that wasn't good. Even then it wasn't good enough, because he said, he would say to her, take your ksuba and go. Because yes, he had some benefit in the diamonds being in the common household, but at the end of the day they were her diamonds, not his. So yeah, maybe he made the calculation, but it didn't take him too long to figure out it was it's cheaper to let her go than to keep the diamonds in the current way. So that wasn't working out either. And look at how Chazal are concerned. All of this is concerned for the woman. There's a fortune when you go through, particularly in Masech, the Ksubis and some of the others in Noshim, to see how far Chazal go to protect the woman's dignity. Ad Shebo Shimon Ben Shetach, and then Shimon Ben Shetach said, "B'tikein," and he introduced legislation, "Shiyeh Kosev Lo Kol Nichsei Achrayin L'Ksuv," that all his movable property is bonded to the Ksuba. And now it's a different story. Now he's got to understand, if he divorces her, what has to happen now? It's not even a simple thing of paying out the cash. Now she goes to the Beis Din, there's a court case, his assets have to be declared, auditors have to come in, he has to kind of recover his assets, liquidate his assets. Now he thinks more carefully, is this really worthwhile? Let's think about this more carefully, maybe we can work out our problems. That's what Chazal want. They want him to get into an analysis mode where he's looking at cost, not just at benefit, and that he slows himself down and gets into the mode that we need him to be. It's so interesting, the psychology of cost, as opposed to all the other things, because what really is perhaps key to life, and it ties into the Mitzvot Yeshorim, what we're just learning too with Mitzvot. What is key to life is really the investments we make, the purchase choices we make. Because if we don't have to pay, then everything's great, everything's wonderful, everything's valuable. it's the only reason we can't have everything is because we can't afford everything, because there's a price tag attached to things, and it's the price tag that makes us think. Without the price tag, we wouldn't think, we would just do. And it's the price tag that sometimes makes us not act. So for example, if a person is not keeping Shabbos, it doesn't necessarily mean he doesn't believe in Shabbos. It could just mean he's not willing to pay the price. Shabbos means there's a whole lot of things I like doing that I can no longer do on Shabbos. Or there's work that I would have to do that I cannot do on Shabbos. Doesn't mean he doesn't believe it's a good thing. Very often we think that people's problems are with their beliefs. And we've done some interesting research with criminals, and we find that their belief system, apart from some of the real gangsters, but most criminals, their belief system is the same as ours. They don't want to see their children in jail. They don't raise their children to do the same things. They're not proud of what they've done. So their belief systems are no different to ours. They believe in the same things. They believe in honesty. They believe in integrity. They believe in family. They believe in all those good things. But when there's an opportunity to get something illegally, they're not willing to pay the price of saying no. That's something that only a human being can do. Paying for something is something only a human being can do. An animal can't do that. There's no commerce in an animal world. The idea of making choices based on cost and being able to pay for something because it's valuable in a different currency. So it's one thing where you pay $1,000 for a share that's worth $1,000. It's an exchange of value. You pay 2 million rand for a house that's worth 2 billion rand. It's an exchange of value. But human beings are capable to do conversions. And to pay 2 million rand for a beautiful painting that other people won't pay 1 million rand for. Just because to me it's valuable. Human beings are capable of paying a lot of money for education, for an experience, for tzedakah, charity. Where do you find an animal giving charity? It's only a human being that can put their hands in their pockets and give something away to somebody else for no personal benefit, for no personal gain. Generosity is a human characteristic. Being willing and able to pay, it's what differentiates people. What you're willing to pay for is what makes people different from one another. We all believe in the same good things. Some of us are willing to pay more for it than others. And what differentiates us is just what we're willing to pay for. And what we have to educate our children is not about what's important. So the father, the parent who sends their children to a Jewish day school or to a yeshiva to learn Torah, but the father doesn't learn Torah. What is the child learning? That we must believe in learning, but not that we must learn. Because what the child picks up is what is the parent willing to make sacrifice for. That's what the child picks up. What is the parent willing to make sacrifices for? And we're a very privileged generation, and our parents too, because we come from parents and grandparents who made great sacrifices for good things. What is it, particularly in this country, in South Africa, the people who came out to South Africa at the beginning of the 20th century or the end of the 19th century came out with nothing. And they made enormous sacrifice. Sometimes not enough sacrifice. Shabbos was the price to keep Shabbos was a price they couldn't pay. And so Shabbos went by the way. But they paid a price. That's why Friday night became an important service in South Africa. It's only in South Africa and to some degree in England that Friday night is an important service. Because what were the parents saying? We can't do it on Shabbos, but at least Friday night. So that understands that there's a Shabbos. And a Shabbos meal, a Friday night meal, when nobody went anywhere else, the whole family came home. Tzedakah was well known. People who weren't keeping Shabbos, but a Rosh Yeshiva would come from overseas to collect money. They would give money. Even poor people would give money to it. The children were raised seeing that. So being raised by parents who made sacrifices for valuable things has been very important for the quality of the South African Jewish community. The question we've got to ask is the next generation. Do our children see us making sacrifices for things that are important? Now when there is wealth available and there is time, now what do they see? Shabbos is not a sacrifice today. Anybody who doesn't keep Shabbos, I can't figure out what's wrong with them. How do you live in this crazy time without one day of slowing down? and there's no big sacrifice. Lots of jobs available where you don't have to work on Shabbos. Lots of businesses that don't operate on Shabbos. There was a time when it wasn't like that. So keeping Shabbos is no big deal. Keeping Shabbos is hedonism. It's just selfish hedonism, just enjoyment. Keeping kashrus, no big sacrifice. Was it a big deal to keep kashrus today? What's so hard about keeping kashrus? What can't you get? Nothing. You can get everything. So kashrus is not a sacrifice. So where are our children seeing us making sacrifices for things that are worthwhile? We see in this piece of Gemara, it's in payment that you define yourself. It's in payment, not in the impulsive choices that we make, not in the choices we make that don't involve payment. It's where you've got to pay a price, where you've got to make an effort. What are you putting that effort in for? What are the things that you're making that effort for? Becomes really, really important. Now, I mentioned to you that it's my father's yahrzeit tonight, and in a couple of weeks' time during Hanukkah is my mother's yahrzeit. And there's some interesting things I was just reflecting today. Some of the interesting things are, I never heard them talk about money. They never talked about money. They didn't have a lot of it at all. But my father was a rabbi and my mother didn't work, so how much was a rabbi paid in those days? Didn't have a lot of money at all. But we never heard about money. And my father used to put money away in the in unit trusts and the stock exchange every month. That's how he used to save up for his retirement. And the stock exchange went up and the stock exchange went down. But we never saw, oh my goodness, the stock exchange collapsed. What's happening? It was never a conversation. It wasn't an issue. And the things that they did spend money on were not tangible things. Although we never felt a loss of tangible things. But the things they really invested money on was travel. We used to travel a lot as children, and not to exotic destinations. We used to travel to Torah centers where we could see other children like us, because in Johannesburg there weren't. When I grew up, we were the only children who wore a yarmulke on the whole of Johannesburg. Even the few frum kids that they were didn't cover their heads at school. Even in the Jewish day, in the Jewish schools, it wasn't done until later on. Once the Yeshiva College opened up, then things started changing. But when there was just King David, that's how it was in those days. And some of you remember those days, but kashrus was hard. There were no kosher places to go, and no kosher products that you could get, and there was no Beis Din guide, and there was no hechsher on things. You couldn't get an OU because you couldn't get imported goods, and the Beis Din didn't used to have a stamp on things. So you used to have homemade. You used to have very little bought products. That was how you used to live. Meat, you have to kasher yourself at home. It was a very different world that they grew up in and lived in. But money was never the issue. There was always money for values. There was always money for Torah. There was always money for learning. There was always money for Yiddishkeit. That just wasn't the case. And many, many people of that generation were like that. And even when they, one of the most fascinating things of all in their lives, I think, was when they emigrated to the United States, where my father started a new rabbinical career at the age of 65, and did more, probably raised a bigger community of B'nai Torah in that period, in his 65 plus, than in all the years before then. So it was a very, very vital time. But when he arrived, soon after he arrived in the United States, he heard that all their possessions that they'd put away in storage, because they didn't know where they were going to land up until they could have a chip, all burnt in a fire and wasn't insured. For some reason they didn't read the small print and it wasn't. So there they arrived in the United States with a mingy South African rand pension and nothing else. Nothing. Suitcases, two suitcases. That's what they had, age 65. And they never spoke about it. They never complained about it. It just wasn't an issue. They were upset about the sforim, they were upset about books, they were upset about the family photographs. That's all they spoke about. There was nothing else that they ever spoke about. It just wasn't an issue. We define ourselves by our relationship to money. And that's why I said there's something quite disappointing in this Gemara, that it's the money that will decide whether, you know, he'll keep his wife or he'll let her go. Oh, this is going to cost a little bit, baby key. So there's something very disappointing in that. But if we get deep into that, how true it is. How true it is that people only think rationally when price is involved. When the price is not involved, they don't think rationally. And where we think about price and where we don't becomes important. when we're about to do something that has no value, we should think about the price. And that's what the Mishnah says. Have you mechashiv, hefsed, schar mitzvah keneged hefseder, hefsed mitzvah keneged schara. Think about the cost of a mitzvah as opposed to its reward, and think about the cost of an avera as opposed to its reward. You want to think about cost as you're about to do something. Think about the cost a little bit. Get into analytical mode about costs when we're about to do certain things, not about the things that are valuable and worthwhile. There we don't have to think of costs. It's just a matter of thinking of their value and of their worth. So that's the piece of Gemara ending with Shimon ben Shetach's Tzakona, that Kol Nichse Achroim Liksufto, and that's the way Ksuvas are written until this day, that a man bonds his property so that in the event of making a divorce decision, he understands that there's a long process of property that and payment that has to be gone through, and that sometimes calms him down and calms them down and enables them to work through their problems and not to take the line of least resistance.